advanced in space exploration or power satellites or anything more complex than a beanbag chair, which made him a damned good public relations man for Astro Corporation as far as Dan was concerned. The worst trap a PR guy can fall into is believing his own propaganda. Kinski wasn't even sure he believed in airplanes. His face was long and horsey, with startling ice-blue eyes that peered out suspiciously from under heavy reddish brows. His ginger-red hair was a thick tangle, like a jungle underbrush almost. Kinski was known to call attention to himself at parties by whipping out an ancient Ronson cigarette lighter and setting his hair on fire. Randolph had seen him do it. As everyone gasped and staggered, Kinski would put out the little blaze with a couple of pats of his hand, grinning and saying, "Wasn't that sensational?" He wasn't smiling now as he approached Randolph, and his Ronson was in his pocket. "How's it going, Len?" Kinski reversed his course like a soldier doing an about-face and fell into step with Randolph. The two men strode swiftly down the corridor toward Dan's office. "Not good, boss. The New York fucking Times ran their usual editorial about keeping people out of space. Practically blamed you for murder." Randolph snorted disdainfully. "So what else is new?" "The Wall Street Journal says pretty much the same, but in a more businesslike way." "How so?" "They say the power sat could be operated entirely by remotely operated machinery. No need for humans in space."
"Yeah," Dan groused. "And rain makes applesauce."
"They quoted 3 different university professors."
Dan banged through the door to his outer office, startling April at her desk. The day any one of those double-dome geniuses starts to operate his own laboratory on campus entirely with remotely operated machinery, without using grad students or any other humans, then I'll believe we won't need human crews at the power set. He pushed through the door to his private office and threw himself into the sculpted chair behind the big ornate desk.
"You know that, boss," said Kinski, dropping into the upholstered chair in front of the desk. "And maybe even I know it. But the media doesn't, and neither do the public."
"Fatheads and fools," Randolph muttered.
"But if you want the government to be on your side..."
"The double-damned government," Randolph snapped.
"I've got a guy from the FAA sitting in Tenney's office. He's all set to shut us down. For good."
"You need friends in high places, boss."
"Maybe I should build a church?"
Kinski's long face took on a crafty look.
"Or see the governor of the state."
"The governor?"
"Governor Scanwell. There's talk that he's considering running for president next year."
"What good's that going to do me?" Randolph demanded.
"Well," Kinski said, "Scanwell's a dark horse, an outsider to Washington politics. He's going to need some issues that the Beltway bandits haven't taken for themselves yet."
Randolph made a sour face. "No major politician has made an issue of space since Kennedy." Shaking his head vigorously, Kinski said,
No, boss. It's not space. It's energy."
"Energy." Hunching forward in his chair eagerly, the PR director said,
"Look, the U.S. is more dependent on oil from the Middle East every year, right? Europe, too."
"Right," said Randolph.
"Every president since Nixon has made noises about energy independence, right? But every year we buy more oil from the Arabs. That oil money funds dictatorships, slavery, attacks on Israel, you name it."
"And terrorism," Randolph muttered.
"Right," Kinski agreed. "And terrorism. Okay, so here's you with Astro Corporation. What are you trying to do?"
"Stay afloat."
"No. You're trying to open up a new source of energy for the U.S. of A. Solar power. Enough energy from one solar power satellite to replace all the fossil fuel and nuclear power plants in all of Texas."
"Or California."
"Or New York."
Dan sank back in his softly yielding chair. "Okay. So we're offering a way off the oil teat. There's nothing new in that."
"But the governor of Texas could use it as a campaign issue. It would bring him instant national attention. International attention."
"You think he'd buck the oil lobby?" Dan scoffed. "In your dreams." Kinski retorted,
"He's already bucking them with the environmental legislation he's pushed through. He won the governorship without oil money."
"By a hair."
"But he won. He beat them."
"Yeah. And with a little luck, maybe a terrorist will blow him up."
So much the better.
Dan shook his head warily. The politicians have backed away from us, Lynn. You know that. God knows I've tried to get political support in Washington. They're just not interested.
That's because you're too goddamned independent for them. And NASA sees you as competition. Nobody in Washington is going to back a new private venture against an existing government agency.
But we're not competition.
As you say it, boss, and rain makes applesauce.
Randolph stared at his PR director. Did you know that phrase came from NASA's first director of public relations? He used it in a children's book he wrote. Kinski shrugged carelessly.
Boss, you should meet the governor.
I already did once, didn't I?
At the rollout ceremony for the space plane, yeah.
He was here for that. So what do I do now? Go to the governor with my hat in my hand and ask him for a handout?
No. You get him to invite you to Austin. And when you get there, you tell him how you can help him get into the White House.
Despite his doubts, Dan smiled. Okay. How do I get him to invite me to Austin?
Leave that to me, boss. That's what I get paid for.
Khartoum, Sudan. The sun was setting over the dusty, picked bare hills. Standing alone at the window of the now-empty conference room, Asim al-Bashir watched the molten red ball sinking slowly, slowly into the parched and dying earth, turning the cloudless hot sky into a bowl of burnished copper, sending long purple shadows across the decaying old stone fortress, the ancient mosque of the city's central square, the modern office and apartment blocks that were already crumbling gradually into disrepair. After 3 days of sometimes bitter discussion, the others of the nine had left the hotel to go their separate ways. They had listened to al-Bashir's plan, incredulous at first, but with slowly increasing understanding. None of them were enthusiastic about it, but at last they had reluctantly given their approval. The power satellite would be used for their purposes, and the Americans would not even realize they had been attacked. But this attack would kill thousands, tens of thousands, and it would humble the arrogant Americans mercilessly. They will turn on themselves after this, al-Bashir thought, rending each other in an eruption of accusations and recriminations. They will do our work for us. And the very idea of a power satellite will be damned forever. Al-Bashir smiled to himself as he saw a future in which the West became even more dependent on oil from the lands of Islam. Oil is power, he told himself. Nothing must be allowed to challenge that power. The cry of a muezzin came wailing faintly from the loudspeakers in the distant mosque's minaret. Come to prayer, come to salvation. Allah is most great. There is no God but Allah. Al-Bashir turned, ready to go back to his hotel room upstairs. He had no intention of taking a chance on being seen outside the hotel, especially at the hour of prayer, when a man in an expensive Western business suit was something to stare at. He was startled to see the Sudanese who had hosted the meeting of the nine standing in the doorway of the conference room, silently watching him. Will you pray with me, my brother? The Sudanese's voice was surprisingly soft and gentle for such a stoutly built man. In his white jalaba and turban, he looked like a mountain of snow, except for his deeply black face. They think of themselves as Arabs, al-Bashir thought, and lord it over their neighbors in the south of the country who have not surrendered to Allah. I will be honored to pray with you, my brother, said al-Bashir. Prayer was not foremost in his thinking. But he agreed to the Sudanese's simple request out of respect for the greatness of Islam, where men of all races were equals. Neither wealth nor poverty, neither family, nor the color of a man's skin, nor the land of one's birth should stand between those who have accepted the faith. The Sudanese led him down a corridor of the hotel to a small private office, which he unlocked with an old-fashioned metal key. He went to a filing cabinet and withdrew two prayer rugs from its bottom drawer. The rug he handed to al-Bashir looked threadbare, almost fragile. My grandfather's, the Sudanese murmured. It was all he had left after